Welcome back in. Hour number three of Robbie and Rex Road here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Robbie Stanley, David Beauclair in today for Joe. Ryan Porth here with you on this Thursday morning in Nashville, Tennessee. Tennessee headed to Omaha to take on the College World Series coming up this weekend. And to help us talk more about that, we go to our 102.5 The Game phone line, driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com, and welcome in Trey Wallace, our good friend from Rocky Top Insider. Trey, what's going on, brother? How are we doing?
Man, not much, buddy. Hope everybody's doing well. Just trying to, get ready for a trip to Omaha, on Saturday.
So, absolutely.
It's been a lot, man. When you don't know how long you're actually going to be somewhere, it's really hard to prepare for the trip.
I would say so.
We're getting it going.
Godspeed to you, Trey, on that front. I want to start with just, look, if you've watched the regional, the super regional, you know the atmosphere at Lindsey Nelson Stadium has been awesome. The community, the campus, the students, everybody's embraced this team. What do you think it's meant so far in terms of the run they've been on for the growth of college baseball? And depending on what happens here in the College World Series, and we've even allowed ourselves to think about a Vandy-Tennessee final at this point, what do you think it can continue to do for the growth of college baseball in this state and specifically with this program with Tony Vitello in Tennessee?
I think it only gets, bigger than what you're trying to do, even from a recruiting standpoint, and what you're trying to put on the field if Tennessee is good again, along with Vanderbilt, because Vanderbilt's going to continue, to do great things in this conference for Tennessee, and they're going to do it nationally. For Tennessee, it's more like, okay, we have the resources, we have everything on campus that we need to make this happen, besides, a stadium that looks decent from the outside, but if you can put it all together, and if you can get the athletic administration behind the baseball, and baseball behind the athletic, and everybody just working together, look, Knoxville is like a powder keg when it comes to baseball, and there's so much, and I hate to divert for a minute, but there's so much amateur baseball that goes on. There's so much youth baseball camps that go on up in Gatlinburg and Pigeon Forge. Like, this is an area that Tony Vitello can really use, to build his program. And I think you've seen that by the players that are coming from in-state. And I think you've seen that from the players that, are within a three-hour driving range, of Knoxville that he has on his roster. So it's been very big from a standpoint of, look, this is exciting. It's something different for us. We're talking about Tennessee athletics in the month of June, and it's not talking about who's quarterback one, in September. So I think it's a very big deal, and I think it can only grow bigger. And I think that's why they're wanting to do is whatever they have to keep Tony Vitello around. Robbie, just because he's built up so much, man.
So, Trey, obviously this lineup right now, 1-9, hitting the ball very well. I mean, they just mashed on Sunday against LSU, putting up 15 runs on the board. Jake Rucker hitting the ball as well as he's hit it all season long. How dangerous is this lineup in this ballpark heading to Omaha, where the field is bigger? It's not the same hitters-friendly park as it is at Lindsey Nelson Stadium. And as you look at kind of the rest of the lineup and the rest of the teams heading into this tournament, where do you think Tennessee's lineup stacks up as they head into Omaha?
It's going to be different, and I hope folks kind of look at it that way. I told folks yesterday, if you think Tennessee's going to go out there and ding out 12 home runs and whatnot and run the score up and make it look like that over a couple of games, it's not. But try to picture it like Tennessee's at the SEC tournament in Hoover, and look how big that field played for Tennessee and how they were able to put it together. Biggest thing for Tennessee is they're going to be able to get, if your Pete Durkays or your Luke Lipsius, players like that are able to get balls into the gap, that's going to be key for Tennessee, because I think they're good enough on the bases to make Virginia pay for it. But again, like we talked about, the Drew Gilberts and the Jake Ruckers, them, knocking bombs out every time they come up, it's just not like that. This ballpark is humid. The wind is usually coming into the stadium. You're not getting much outward. And I think they only had a combined 12 home runs between all teams during the last College World Series that went down in Omaha. So this is going to be an interesting atmosphere, but I think Tennessee, if they could do what they have to do by just getting the ball in play, and I think guys like Liam Spence and Max Ferguson do a really good job of that. And then if they, you know, if they can do what they did like in Knoxville, you know, play the line, play the foul lines if you can. That's where Tennessee's success is going to come from. And I think they could do that against Virginia's pitching. I think looking at Virginia, I'm not going to act like I know their lineup up and down, but, you know, they do have one or two really good pitchers that I've seen. But where they fall off at is they have nothing else behind that, and then they don't have anything really from their, let's say, 69 hitters. Where Tennessee, you know, that's where Tennessee's kind of lived off this year. A lot of people don't you know, look at it that way, Robbie. But they're so good on the back end that it makes up for anything that they're missing on the front end. So, yeah, no, I think Tennessee is going to be just fine next week.
Trey, David Beauclair here. How much does it help with the schedule? You know, Tennessee doesn't have like the dominant starters. They've got a good quality pitching staff. The schedule of not necessarily playing every day right at the start, how much does that help them sort of navigate with their pitching staff through this thing?
I think it's pretty big, David. And when you look at, so take for instance, Will Heflin. He was their Friday night guy all during the SEC season. Well, he hasn't pitched since the SEC tournament in a live game atmosphere. It's not, you know, not because they didn't want to. Oh, I'm sorry, the NCAA regional part of it. He hasn't pitched. So it's not because they didn't need him to. It's just there's, you know, when you roll with Chad Dallas on a Friday night, and then you roll with Blade Tidwell, or whether it be Saturday, Sunday, you know, Tennessee's figured out a way right now to kind of tweak the rotation in a sense. And I don't think it's going to be a big deal, because I think that what they're going to do is they're going to throw Dallas on Sunday, and then when they turn around and have to play Tuesday, either in the winners or the losers bracket, most likely the winners bracket, that's when you throw Blade Tidwell. And so you're leaving Heflin in there either to get you out of a jam if you need to be, or he can come back and start for you on Friday. And then if you turn it around, David, Tennessee's rotation would be pretty much all set in stone beginning that Monday once they would start the championship series if they got that far. So rotation-wise, I think they're going to be fine, because I think, you know, with Sean Hundley and Camden Sewell in the pen, I think it helps them out. Now, Tennessee's problem, David, they don't want to get far into their bullpen, because they have to do that. If you saw something like you saw against LSU this past weekend where they threw around six pitchers, that's where Tennessee is going to get into a lot of trouble, is them trying to mess around and go to their third guy, fourth guy in the pen. So I'm interested, David, to see how this rotation works out with the schedule.
Trey Wallace from Rocky Top Insider has been our guest here on Robbie and Rex Road. Trey, one of the best in the business. Appreciate you taking time to join us this morning, brother.
Hey, Robbie, thanks so much, man, and I appreciate you guys having me on, and y'all have a great weekend.
Absolutely. You as well. Thanks, have fun Trey. In Omaha. Trey Wallace joining us here on Robbie and Rex Road. When we come back, we'll react a little bit to what Trey had to say there and also get into the hot topic in college football right now. It looks like we're headed to a 12-team playoff. Is that good for college football? Is that bad for college football? We'll get to that coming up next. This is Robbie and Rex Road here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Go to thegamenashville.com to check out Nashville's best deals. This week's new deal is a $50 gift card for only $25 to Nashville's newest and largest axe-throwing venue, Bat Axe Throwing, Nashville and downtown at 648 Fogg Street. Aim for a great time at Bat Axe Throwing Nashville while enjoying panoramic downtown views, live music on the Bat Axe stage, curated cocktails from the full bar, and a Northwoods-inspired menu with a southern twist. Other deals happening include a $30 Boom Boss Craft Pizza and Tap House gift card for only $15. Buy one, get one free for Beach Bend Park and Splash Lagoon, a $30 Party Foul gift card for only $15, and $20 Grain and Berry gift card for only $10. You can get yours now and get more information while they last at thegamenashville.com. Welcome back in, Robbie and Rex Road, here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Robbie Stanley, David Beauclair, Ryan Porth here with you on this Thursday morning. David, you ever done any of the axe throwing out there that's all the rage right now?
I have not done the axe throwing. I did it in the backyard when I was a kid. Broke my dad's little hatchet. He was not happy about it. I remember that. But I saw a video not too long ago of a guy doing axe throwing. Have you seen this? There's like a stump between him and the target, and he's bouncing it off the stump, and it's going incredible. In every time.
That takes a lot of practice.
That seems a bit extreme to me, but yeah, okay.
I hate to see what the attempts were like trying to build yourself up to that point.
That's right.
What could have happened with
nothing
those?
Nothing could have gone wrong, I'm sure. Yes.
You can find some interesting videos nowadays. So, David, it seems like we're headed towards a 12-team playoff in college football, and Ross Dellinger came out with a story yesterday kind of detailing the process that it's been like to get to this point where basically this has been – an ongoing discussion for the last 2 years, and it's been kept under wraps. I mean, everything's been on the table. They've discussed an 18 playoff. At what point, a 24-team playoff was on the table as well, and it looks like 12 is going to be where they settle. What do you think about this? Is this good for college football to expand the playoff from 4 to 12? Could it be bad? What do you think the consequences will be as you look to the college football landscape and expanding this to 12 teams for the playoff?
I'm okay in a vacuum. We'll put it this way. In a vacuum, I'm okay with a 12-team, even a 16-team playoff. I think that would be interesting. But if you're going to do that, you're going to have to completely reimagine what college football is and how the season works and you know, the whole bowl game model and all that. It's you're gonna have to change things, because let's face it, what college football has sold us on, even through changes with the BCS into the college football playoff and everything, what college football has sold to us is that every game in the regular season matters. Every weekend is important. If you're going to a 12-team playoff, you just look at the CFP rankings from 2014 to 2019. Every single year, if you take the top 12, at least one three-loss team is going to make the playoffs. In 2016, there were five three-loss teams among the top 12. So this idea that you can't afford to trip up in the regular season, that every single Saturday is life and death, you've got to tune in, you've got to watch, that goes out the window. So I don't want to hear that anymore. You're going to have to reimagine the whole thing and sell me on something else now.
Not great. No, I think that's been one of the best parts about watching college football, is because the regular season has meant so much to this point. And the way they're setting it up now with the 12-team playoff that's on the table, basically the sixth, you're going to have six at-large bids under this new format that's been proposed, and six conference championships, the highest-ranked conference champions. And they put that in case, like, you know, I think the example they used in this article was Trevor Lawrence goes down on the first drive of the ACC title game and Pittsburgh sneaks up at 7-5 and takes down Clemson. Like, do they really need to be a top six seed at that point? Probably not.
Right.
So I'm glad they've kind of built in some insurance that way. And I think, you know, a big part of this is seeing whether or not you could find a way to get a group of five team in and pour your beloved Cincinnati Bearcats. Maybe they're a candidate for that this year with the 12-game playoff. Too bad it's not happening this year.
I mean, if they were going to adopt this, then why not just do it this year so that the Bearcats could get in?
By the time they do it, maybe Luke Fickell's gone.
Probably.
as an avowed SEC snob, too, This is just college football's latest attempt to keep the SEC from taking over.
Yep.
Because that's what the whole college football playoff was all about. You know, I'm convinced the impetus for the college football playoff was the LSU Alabama BCS championship game. That, you know, there was no doubt that those were the two best teams that year, and it irritated the crap out of everybody other than the SEC. And and what's becoming harder and harder for the college football playoff committee to do is to say that that the top four teams do not include at least two SEC teams. But you know, that was, people forget that when the college football playoff was created and announced, it was the top four teams, quote, with an emphasis on conference champions. The golden idea was we're going to get four conference champions, the best four conference champions, and put them together. That way we never have two SEC teams competing for a national championship again. It's getting harder and harder for them to do that because the Big 12 can't hold its weight if Oklahoma manages to get tripped up along the way.
The Pac-12 is a non-factor.
They're saying now that okay, if our best chance of keeping the SEC from taking over is just to let more people in and hope somebody knocks them off and we don't end up with two SEC teams in there.
Oh, I think you're exactly right, and I think a big part of it, of going to 12 teams is the Pac-12. I mean, it was non-existent at that point. And I do think from this standpoint, going to 12, maybe it's better for some of your West Coast teams where, quite frankly, their programs right now, the state of the conference, the state of the programs, they're just not as good as you look around the rest of the league. Maybe this helps generate interest longer out there. But to me, what's going to end up happening on this is 12 teams, you're going to end up having – three, maybe in some years four SEC teams in this playoff, and it's going to be right back to the same thing.
But and the issue with the bowl game model is, you know, these bowl games fund conference offices. You know, they were created by conference offices as a way to make money for the conference, and there's still a lot of that. But if the Pac-12 isn't getting into one of these, you know, because these are still bowl games, quote unquote, in the college football playoff. If the Pac-12 isn't getting into one of these highest paying bowl games, they're saying, "Wait a minute, we're not getting the money that everybody else is getting." Yeah, I mean, but the SEC, if they get two teams in there again, which, you know, SEC is the second richest conference behind the Big Ten, it's only a matter of time before the SEC is making more money than the Big Ten, and you know, the television executives in the East Coast are not going to like that at all. So this whole thing, the whole sport is trying to figure out how to stop the inevitable, which is it's pretty much the case already that the SEC is the epicenter, rules college football. There's just no way around it.
Christopher on Periscope says, one question I have is, how does this affect scheduling in terms of how many games are going to be played?
If the NCAA cares about student athletes, which I don't know that it does, but if the NCAA does, then what you have to do is sort of go to like an 8-game season and then let schools sort of figure out another two or three games, not non-conference games, but maybe, you know, you play one or two non-conference games, then you play a conference schedule of six games, say, and then you have sort of almost a bowl game atmosphere. Hey, we liked you over in this conference. We think, you know, we match up well with you now. Let's get a game where you almost like 3 weeks out, you start scheduling your last two or three weeks. That's what I'd like to see. I don't know. I mean, ADs might tell me there's no way in the world you can do that. You can pull that off. I don't know. But you absolutely have to shorten the season in some way and then let the teams that don't make the playoffs figure out a way to make a little extra money on the back end while the playoff teams are gearing up and getting their thing going.
Let's go back to the text line driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com. Got a texter that says, the parity element is why March Madness is such a huge TV draw. The upset element is always there. The way this 12-team playoff is headed, we're going to be in store for lots of blowouts early. Outside of the playoff fan bases, I don't think fans will be all in for an Alabama-Northwestern matchup or Clemson taking on Memphis. I hear what you're saying on that front. My counter argument to that would be there's already a lot of blowouts in the college football playoff.
And Alabama and Clemson fans seem to enjoy when their teams kick the crap out of somebody else. I don't think that'll ever get old for them.
And for the people who like to dabble, they'll be watching.
That's true.
Yeah. Well, that's the college football playoff as it is. I mean, has already wrecked the bowl system too. Like it used to be, whatever flaws were in the bowl system, which a lot of times you didn't get the two best teams matched up to try and figure out who was the national champion. But bowl season was a thing where you started watching in mid-December, and pretty much every night you check, hey, is there a bowl game on tonight? Like, I'll never forget one of my favorite memories. One night I was sat down and I was flipped on the TV and there was nothing on. I started watching the Motor City Bowl between Ole Miss and Marshall. And Tammy Beauclair comes walking in the room a few minutes later and she sits down and kind of doesn't say anything for a minute or two. And she's like, is there nothing else on? And I said, honestly, there is nothing else on.
Yes,
there is nothing. Let's just watch this game for a little bit. Well, that was Randy Moss's last year at Marshall. And it turned into a tremendous football game. It was high scoring. It was back and forth. We didn't move for 3.5 hours. We watched that game. Nowadays, I would not have that experience.
No.
Because the college football playoff has told me that these bowl games in mid-December are meaningless. There is nothing to them. There's no point to them. All that matters is the college football playoff. Before you sort of built your way up to New Year's Day and that was exciting, that doesn't happen anymore. So that's why I say you're going to have to do away with that. Give the other teams a way to figure out, okay, we need two more games for our guys now. We didn't make the playoffs, but our guys deserve to do some more. You know, figure out what that is. I don't know, but the bowl game system is done. It's over. If you go to a 12-game playoff, just forget it. Nobody is going to be tuning into these games.
Coming up next, we will get back into the Titans and this offense. What should the expectations be for the offense as the Titans head into the 2021 NFL season? We'll take your thoughts on our text line, driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com, 615-737-1025, 615-737-1025. Robbie Stanley alongside David Beauclair. You're listening to Robbie and Rex Road here on ESPN 1025 The Game. Tomorrow, it's your chance to participate in the Nashville SC Pick to Click, brought to you by Camarena Tequila. If you guess correctly which player scores a goal in the game tomorrow night, you win a prize pack and a 4-pack of tickets to an upcoming Nashville SC home game. The next chance to participate is tomorrow morning at 9:45. Welcome back in, Robbie and Rex Road, here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Robbie Stanley, David Beauclair, Ryan Porth here with you on this Thursday morning in Nashville, Tennessee, discussing the Tennessee Titans. And David, we talked about this a little bit earlier in the show. Derrick Henry back on the field at minicamp. Julio Jones coming in as well. There are a lot of pieces to work with this offense. Derrick Henry spoke yesterday about the addition of Julio Jones and what that means for this offense as they come back into camp here and get ready for the season coming up in a few weeks. Here's what Titans running back Derrick Henry had to say.
My question is, just in regards to what Julio brings to the table and just how it opens things up for you as a back, can you just kind of get into what that does, you know, adding him to the picture?
Well, I mean, he's a dynamic player. One of not the best receivers in this league. So, you know, he's definitely respected by defenses. And, you know, I mean, I don't really get into all the, you know, boxes and, you know, different type of scenarios. I think we just try to put it all together while we're here and just try to work and, you know, try to make each other better. And, you know, each and every day, you know, he likes to work hard. I like to work hard. And that's all, you know, we're trying to bring to the table, you know, as far as being teammates and, you know, the whole team is making each other better. Not really getting to, you know, what this be like and that would be like, this trying to put it all together. Come here, work every day, get better, be a great teammate, and see what we can do.
So that was Derrick Henry yesterday after minicamp. And David, we know this. I mean, the expectations for this offense coming into the season are going to be sky high with Julio Jones coming into the fold. You've got Derrick Henry in the backfield as well, A.J. Brown, and not to mention Ryan Tannehill has been pretty good since he came over here as well at the quarterback position. What do you think are fair expectations for this Titans offense as they head into a new season with a new offensive coordinator and some new moving parts that they're trying to piece together?
You know, a fair expectation, I think, is to be pretty darn close to where you were for most of last year, which is, I think it's reasonable to say this team should be scoring at least 24 points a game. Like, yes, things are going to happen. You're going to have, but more often than not, 24 and up should be a reasonable number. I think it's reasonable to expect that if this team gets behind by 14 points, you can you can answer that. You can answer that fairly quickly in some ways. And I think it's reasonable to expect a number of big plays. You might not have as many 12 play 85 yard drives as you did last year. You know, you don't have Jonnu Smith, you don't have Adam Humphries. Those guys were chain movers. Though, you know, you look at the percentage of catches they had that went for first downs. Even Corey Davis, you know, a huge percentage of his catches were for first downs. You don't have those guys, but what you have is Derrick Henry, who's a home run threat at all times. You have Julio Jones, who's a home run threat at all times. You have AJ Brown, who's a home run threat at all times. So I think it's reasonable to expect maybe a few more three-play 70-yard drives and a few less 12-play 85-yard drives from this bunch.
I think so, too. And I look at this offense, and you know, I'm interested to see how quickly they can put things together. I mean, we knew it right from the jump last year with Arthur Smith kind of being in his second full season. The offense didn't have that much changeover from the year before. I mean, they were productive pretty much right from the jump in the season last year, and they had to be because the defense was – atrocious last year all season long. I look at the defense this year with the new parts coming in. You've got Shane Bowen in year two, although maybe technically year one as the defensive coordinator with the Titans. I think there's a chance this defense, as you're trying to kind of incorporate Bud Dupree in the lineup and some of the younger pieces in the secondary as well, I think there's a chance this defense could struggle early on. So I think there's pressure there for the offense to be ready to go quickly. I'm interested to see how quickly they can do that. I mean, I think about what could be in store for us in the first game of the year with Arizona coming in with Kyler Murray and DeAndre Hopkins on the other side. You're going to need to score some points in that game to win that game. I think there's pressure very quickly on this Titans offense.
And Russell Wilson and the Seahawks in week two. And, you know, you mentioned Arthur Smith, and this is one of those things that you're not going to be able to quantify, and you're probably not going to be able to get anybody to really talk about it honestly, but it's fascinating to me. The one thing that was abundantly clear over the last 2 years is that Ryan Tannehill and Arthur Smith were sort of one mind.
Yep.
You know, those two guys, they just got each other automatically, and the sense is that there were – you know, how many times during the last 2 years where Arthur Smith probably called a play and Ryan Tannehill in his mind is going, that's exactly what I was thinking.
Yep.
You know, I mean, we heard it in stark comparison to Marcus Mariota, for example, when the quarterback and coordinator meet on Fridays and say, okay, what do you like in the game plan? What don't you like? That apparently those discussions were a lot shorter, a lot quicker, a lot more agreement with Tannehill than they were with Mariota, because you know, just Arthur Smith and Ryan Tannehill apparently see the game the same way. They think the game the same way. They just understood each other perfectly. Can Ryan Tannehill have that same kind of relationship with Todd Downing? Todd Downing's a different guy. He's a different personality. He probably has a different set of preferences in some circumstances. And whatever the difference is, whether it's a little difference, a big difference, how does that translate on the field, particularly in critical moments in close games when you have to get a first down, when you have to go and put points on the board? That's again, I don't know that you're going to be able to quantify that, but if things don't look quite as good or if things don't happen quite as dramatically in those late game moments, that's something to keep in the back of your mind is, hey, maybe that's what it is.
Well, I think there's a lot of pressure on Todd Downing, for sure. I mean, that's kind of the subject of our poll question today as well at 1025 The Game on Twitter. Which Titans coordinator faces more pressure in the 2021 season? Is it Shane Bowen or is it Todd Downing? Right now, 69% of the vote says Shane Bowen, 31% going with Todd Downing. I do, though. I think there's a pretty high amount of pressure on Todd Downing anyway, not from the standpoint of losing his job necessarily, but you're coming in anyway before Julio Jones, and you're taking over for a guy that just got a head coaching job, a top three offense in the NFL. You've got a 2,000-yard back in the backfield, mean, there are a lot of weapons there to begin with, and then Julio Jones gets added in, and I think whether it's fair or unfair, the expectation outwardly from a lot of Titans fans and from a lot of NFL people around the league is, well, this offense should be, if not the best offense in the league, right there with Kansas City. That's a pretty high bar.
It's an interesting question in that they're two dramatically different situations. You know, the first rule of employment in any business is you never want to follow somebody who was great.
Yep.
And Todd Downing is following somebody who was undeniably great and who has, you know, numbers that put up numbers that were out the roof that are going to be very difficult to match. Shane Bowen is following Shane Bowen / Mike Vrabel, whatever the defensive pairing was last year, which was terrible.
Yep.
You know, in a way, Shane Bowen has almost nowhere to go but up.
That is true.
In this now, my answer to the question is still Shane Bowen is under more pressure because I think a bad season and he gets fired. I think a bad season for Todd Downing, they probably give him a do-over and say, well, you know, we'll give you one more crack at it. But they are absolutely in two. It's remarkable to be on the same team, and both guys were here and part of the staff in slightly different roles. But their situations are 180 degree polar opposites.
I'd probably say my vote on that would be Todd Downing.
Really?
It would be because he has a higher bar to maintain than Shane Bowen. I mean,
well, there's no question about that.
I mean, like David said, I mean, the shoes that he's trying to fill with Arthur Smith and that being a top five offense last year, that's a high bar, even though he has the weapons to do it. If they don't do it, I think there's going to be a lot of eyes on him. If the defense doesn't do it, I think a lot of eyes are going to be on Mike Vrabel because of how much he's botched this whole defensive coordinator thing here in the last 12 months.
And let's be honest, a week and a half ago, this wasn't even a question. Todd Downing had very little pressure on him, given the losses on offense, until you get Julio Jones.
Yep.
Now, all of a sudden, you know, and that's the thing. Like, if you looked at the wide receiver group a week and a half ago, you said it's not good enough. But maybe that's what has to happen, and Derrick Henry's back there, and they'll find a way to make it work. You go from, in one move, you go from not good enough to saying, okay, A.J. Brown and Julio Jones in the same breath as Chris Godwin and Mike Evans,
yep,
or Lockett and Metcalf in Seattle, or, you know, whatever the best wide receiver tandems you want to name, the Titans all of a sudden are now in that discussion. And that changed the expectations and everything completely for Todd Downing in that moment.
Agreed. And with that in mind, how do you go about handling that if you're Todd Downing? What's your approach to this offense? How much different should it look next year under Todd Downing with this Titans offense? We'll talk about that coming up next. This is Robbie and Rex Road here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Welcome back in, Robbie and Rex Road here on ESPN 102.5 The Game, streaming live on Periscope, on YouTube, and on Twitch as well. We've got Brian Finneran, former Falcons wide receiver, now with 680 The Fan, joining us to begin the 9 o'clock hour. We'll get into a little Julio Jones talk with him coming up to begin the 9 o'clock hour in about 12 minutes or so. So looking forward to that conversation with him. Right now, talking Titans and this offense, and offensive coordinator Todd Downing. David Beauclair in today. David, as you watch this Titans offense, how the pieces are coming together, and we've talked about the pressure on Todd Downing and how that shifted with Julio Jones coming in. If you're Todd Downing, how do you approach this year? Is it going to look much different, do you think, if you're Todd Downing from a schematic standpoint with Julio Jones coming into the fold? Obviously, with A.J. Brown, with Derrick Henry, with Julio Jones, a lot of guys that are used to getting the ball on a fairly regular basis. How do you go about handling that if you're Ryan Tannehill and Todd Downing? A lot of questions with this offense. What's your best advice to Todd Downing as he enters his first year with the Titans as offensive coordinator in terms of how to handle the challenges he's got in front of him with this offense?
I say don't overthink it. You know, coaches love to say it's about the Jimmys and Joes, not the X's and O's, right? And you've got pretty good Jimmys and Joes there. The idea being ultimately somebody's just got to beat the guy in front of him. Well, Derrick Henry, A.J. Brown, Julio Jones, those three guys are all capable of beating the guy in front of them much more often than not. So, do what you do. Don't feel compelled to make big changes to this offense. You know, we saw the things Corey Davis did last year in terms of the deep crosses and taking advantage of sucked up linebackers on the play action, or the, you know, the post pattern where you get matched up with a safety when there's an extra man in the box. Do those things with Julio Jones, right? Julio Jones can do those things
really well,
better than Corey Davis has done them over his career. So don't feel like you need to all of a sudden put in all these route combinations to highlight Julio somewhere or whatnot. That wouldn't make any sense to me to do that. Part of the reason you were hired was because you know this playbook. You've been involved in this playbook for the last couple of years. So don't come with a Todd Downing offense. You can be Todd Downing play caller, but play to your strengths here. Keep it simple. I don't think this is a situation that calls for a lot of creativity.
So we've talked about this, and Joe's thrown it out there. I mean, the Titans, I think last year they ran the ball the third most in the league. And you know, you've got teams like the Ravens that utilize the running back a little bit more, or excuse me, the quarterback a little bit more in the running game than the Titans do, obviously. So I would be interested to see what those numbers look like just purely from the running back position. They're probably at the top of the league in that standpoint. Do you think that changes at all with Julio Jones coming in? Let's say the Titans are whatever they were last year, 52% run, 48% pass. Do you think that changes? Do you think that flip-flops? Do you throw the ball anymore? Are you tempted to throw the ball anymore if you've got Julio Jones in the fold?
No, I think you're tempted to throw the ball more because you feel like your chances for success are really, really good on almost every snap. But I don't think you change that ratio if you can help it, because the whole idea of the offense is still built around Derrick Henry's strength, and whether he's getting the handoff or whether it's the threat of the handoff, that's still what this offense is. Like for Julio, what I would expect, if you're a fantasy football player, this is something to think about here. What I would expect from Julio is you're not going to see the catch numbers he had in Atlanta. I don't think he's going to catch 80 balls or 90 balls or whatever. I just don't think there's going to be the opportunity for that. But in terms of yards per reception, I would think, assuming he's healthy, it'll be as good, if not better, than it's ever been. I think there'll be a whole lot of his catches that go for 15 yards or more, or even 20 yards or more, because he's going to be the guy going down the field winning jump balls on long throws or taking, like I said, catching those balls in the open spaces and running with them. He'll have 10 catches in a game, maybe two, but I think more likely a realistic number for him is 3, 4, 5 most games. But he's a guy who could have a 3-catch, 105-yard, 2-touchdown performance kind of thing, and I would think everybody'd be pretty satisfied with that if that's how it turns out.
I would think so too, and I'm interested to see how this could affect Derrick Henry in terms of how defenses go about defending this offense. Because to your point, a week and a half ago, you look at this and you say, all right, you've got to be aware of A.J. Brown. There's no question about that. But the focal point of stopping this offense is Derrick Henry. We're putting 7 in the box, 8 in the box, and we're going to try to shut him down and see if Tannehill can beat us that way. We think Tannehill has shown at times that he can. Now, Titans fans will be quick to point out they'd like to see that a little bit more in the playoffs, and certainly against Baltimore, there were some opportunities there, and they did not take advantage of that. So that's got to get better as they move forward. But to me, if I'm the Titans, like if you want to put 8 in the box, okay, go right ahead. You've got Julio on the outside now. You've got A.J. Brown on the outside now. You go one-on-one with those guys often enough throughout the course of the game, I like my chances pretty well to make some plays down the field. So it's going to be interesting to me to see how defenses go about doing that, and if they put 8 in the box less, how much that helps Derrick Henry in the running game maybe be as productive, maybe even more so than we saw a year ago.
I think you're still going to see a prevalence of eight in the box because, or I'm going the other way. You're going to see a little less of that because teams are still going to want to make you try and drive the field. What they don't want to give up is the big play.
Yep.
So that goes back to where I say I don't think the ratio will change. I think there's going to be plenty of opportunity to run the ball. Teams are not going to be saying, okay, just flat out, Derrick Henry, you're not going to beat us. Somebody else is going to have to. Because if Julio Jones beats you, it's one play, 75-yard drive, and you know right away you're having to send your offense back on the field, going, what just happened? Whereas you know analytics will tell you it you know the odds of a team getting X number of first downs on a particular drive are you know. Decrease exponentially as that number rises, as X rises. So I think, you know, still that's how you defend in this day and age. You want to make teams try and drive the ball. And even though Derrick Henry is going to be very good at that and very effective in that, that's still teams don't want to give up the big play. And they're gonna think sooner or later we're going to hold Derrick Henry to 2 yards, 2 yards, and then get an incomplete pass and get off the field.
When we come back, we'll be joined by Brian Finneran, former Falcons wide receiver, and with 680 The Fan, and to discuss Julio Jones and this Titans offense, what he can bring to the table. Looking forward to that conversation coming up with him. Right now, though, we've got some tickets to give away for Nashville SC taking on Toronto FC coming up on June the 23rd. Ryan Porth, do you have a trivia question to give away a pair of tickets on our text line, driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com?
I do.
All right. What's your trivia question?
The trivia question is there are two nationalities, so two countries, that are tied atop the all-time leaderboard in terms of titles in the UEFA European Championship. Obviously, right now it's the UEFA Euro 2020,
yep.
Even though it's 2021.
It is
so
that.
What two countries are tied with three titles in the UEFA Euro Championship?
If you know the answer to that question, hit up our text line at 615-737-1025, 615-737-1025, and you can win some tickets to see Nashville SC take on Toronto FC coming up on June 23rd at Nissan Stadium. When we come back, we'll be joined by Brian Finneran. We'll do that next. You're listening to Robbie and Rex Road live from the Wholesaling Studios, powered by RumbleOn.com here on ESPN 102.5 The Game.